David. Brilliant to see everybody here tonight. Wendy, absolutely amazing. What a tour de force. I'm not even remotely going to try and do this. I'm going to bring you right down from that incredible scenario of global regulation straight to the coalface, if I may. So this is all about how does it actually work at the coalface, as we like to say, what's happening in AI. So let me just touch a little bit on, well, what is it? A question we don't often go into. How does it create value? What goes wrong? And hence, maybe, as we see the discussion, how might we think about the appropriate way to regulate something like AI? So what is it? I'd like you to take the following lens. If you think of any organization, whether that's a university, a commercial company, a charity or whatever, the Royal Society, there's a lens you can put on, which is an organization is a decision-making machine. And lots of organizations take very large number of decisions. And fundamentally, AI is no more complicated than a decision-making machine that takes a bunch of inputs that we typically translate into some kind of numerical form so we can turn it into bits and bytes and what have you. It applies some form of algorithm and translate it into a series of outputs, which again, we tend to put mathematically and translate it. So that's all it really does. It takes inputs and it produces outputs. And obviously you need a lot of models, you need this, but that's fundamentally what it does. And by the way, and this is my slight beef, if we'd called it applied statistics, we'd never have got the funding, but it might have been a bit more honest about what it actually is. So there you go. So a question that I ask a lot of business leaders, which is, okay, you've heard the hype. How does AI actually create value? What is it that AI does that can actually add any value at all to your organization, whether that's societal or economic or commercial value? And if you take that lens of AI as a part, the lens of an organization as a decision-making machine, you know, you can get humans to take your decisions, you can throw dice to take your decisions, you can ask machines to take decisions. And when you say, okay, AI creates value through making decisions, quite often in conversations I have, there's a bit of a type error. Because if you think about a decision-making machine or organization, you've got two dimensions. Apologies to all the mathematicians in the room. You've got fidelity, bluntly, do you make good decisions or bad decisions? And you've got velocity, do you make fast decisions or slow decisions? And the kind of implicit assumption when you look at a lot of debates about should we automate this, should we replace humans with AI, should we deploy, the implicit assumption is that AI creates value by making better decisions. You know, we could make amazing decisions. We now have an AI that's capable of looking at a, you know, a photograph of a skin and doing a better job than the world's best panel of oncologists about whether you might have skin cancer. Awesome. You know, it may not. It's almost completely irrelevant. If you actually go and look at AI deployment in the real world, the value-creating lever is not that it improves the quality of decisions. It may not. Is that it massively improves the velocity of decision-making. And massively improves doesn't mean three times or five times faster. It means a billion times faster or 10 billion times faster. And this is not a given, but it turns out in lots of domains, if you massively increase the velocity of decision-making, you can hugely increase the granularity. And in many domains, that turns out to be extraordinarily value-creating. I'll give you three simple examples. we know that if you take a retinal eye scan, we actually know we have pretty good models. We know that retinal eye scans are actually very good indicators of lots of major health diseases. Diabetes, cancer, cardiovascular can be spotted by looking at a retinal eye scan. And we know we have human experts who are actually very good at looking at these in detail and saying, yep, here's something, make a referral. So that's brilliant. Problem is we don't have very many human experts. Do you know how many retinal eye scans we did in the UK last year? We did 900,000 retinal eye scans. And we have a few dozen human experts, so we might have looked at 100. Now, if we've got an AI algorithm, which is pretty good, and remember, this is only ever probabilistic, it's predictive, but imagine if you ran every single, because you know, every time somebody goes into a high street optician and gets that thin, there's an image, run it through a good enough algorithm, and you'll suddenly narrow down to, let's say, the top 0.1% or the top 1% that might be candidates for that. Bingo, you have created tremendous value. Tremendous value. Simple deployment, it's about velocity. Give another example. We've been doing a bit of work at the Alan Turing Institute with the Met Office on a really simple question, which is, let's figure out how to improve weather forecasting. Simple. Actually, it's a deeply hard problem. Is that right, Wendy? And it's a deeply hard problem. Let me throw my man back to my good old-fashioned mathematician days, because this is a chaotic dynamic system, which means that tiny changes in the initial boundary conditions can have an exponential growth and things. So it is almost impossible to do a deterministic model that has good accuracy in the long term. Never mind what happens when real weather systems hit a pothole or a bump in the road or a school. It's really hard. So you spend insane amount of monies building supercomputers with basically fluid dynamic physics models that are pretty good at saying there's a large cloud wobbling this way. Bloody useless at saying, is my village going to flood tomorrow? And that's what we care about. So what's been interesting at the Turing is we said, well, maybe if you took a physics-constrained machine learning model, i.e. machine learning very good at predicting from history what might happen, never perfect, but you know that absorbs some of that micro-complexity and also enables you to get much more granular because we've got 150 years of historic weather information. When did it actually flood? What was the relative level relative to the wind speed, the wind direction, the precipitation, etc.? And you can do just pure Google DeepMind, have got a pretty good one, pure machine learning models. But actually what's interesting, what if you took a physics-constrained machine learning model blended? Nature paper just coming out on this. And actually it turns out these are pretty good. And in fact, they're particularly good in sparse data areas. So we now have predictive capacity for places like sub-Saharan Africa, where there aren't many sensors that are way better than traditional models. But that's not really the point. The real point is the first test we said, can we match the predictive accuracy of an existing weather supercomputer, which only took about 3 months, but it's six orders of magnitude cheaper and faster, a million times cheaper and faster. And that suddenly means everybody can have a supercomputer weather forecaster, which at minimum means you could do this. And what's quite exciting is that in a world first, the Met Office is currently building physics-constrained AI into production weather forecasting. So watch this space. Those little things you see are actually going to be powered by AI, which is awesome. Physics-constrained AI. So that's great. I'll give you one final example. My day job is looking after the Natural History Museum. And an interesting question we came to at the Natural History Museum is, how do you date a dinosaur fossil? It's a really important question to paleontologists and others who care about deep time. And it's quite a hard thing to do because it's a lump of stone in another lump of stone. And they all look about the same and you've got a 200 million year time span to try and date it. It's quite a hard problem. Turns out you can do it if you take a tiny scrape of the substrate, so it might be in a chalk substrate or a sandstone, you tend to find what we call nanofossils, which is the pollens, the planktons, and things like this. And these are actually very good indicators over time because they evolve, they change. You can get pretty good accuracy if you can really do this. Problem is, to do that, you have to scrape a little bit off, put it on a microscope slide, look at it. You take a trained postdoc, let's call him Tom, because that's his name. You take a trained postdoc, and to get a good dating, you need about 2,000 observations. So that is 10 days of Tom, trained postdoc, 8 hours a day, staring down a microscope saying, that's triangular, that's square, that's this, that, the other. It's a pretty boring job. Does that be fair? And by the way, this is a commercial surface that all of the construction companies and drilling companies use when they want to hit a rock and say, how old is it, what's it made from? So we said, you know what, we spun up an AI team at the Natural History Museum a few years ago, and we said, well, okay, Tom, let's put you together with one of our machine learning guys and see if we can do any better. And so they built a model, very simple, take the image, tessellate it into small things, so you only have one or two things, do some sort of standard computer vision stuff. Again, took them only about sort of 4 or 5 weeks. They've now got a model, which is 98.5% accurate, it's pretty good, 30,000 times faster, which, by the way, means we're now about to sell this as a commercial service because we can undercut everybody else's pricing who's using Tom Mark II to stare down the microscopes. So simple thing, how does AI create value? Speed, velocity. Now, what goes wrong? I loved Wendy's, what was it you said? The existential threat is rubbish. I mean, yeah, it is, it's complete rubbish. And by the way, damaging rubbish, I would argue, because it is hugely distracted from some genuine things we should be worrying about. There are really legitimate societal concerns. I'll give you a couple of examples. Imagine an organization that has started to delegate decision-making to machines, and there are a lot of them right now. Every day, as we sit here today, billions of decisions have been made by machines. Credit reference checks, you know, inventory placement, pricing, all of these things are being automated. And there's a class of activity that back in my Amazon day, we used to call, how do you manage the machines? We've had 100 plus years of the art and science of managing people. We're very early in the stages of managing machines, and machines go wrong. Bad data feeds, stale algorithms, this sort of stuff. And when they go wrong, they can go wrong catastrophically quickly. And how many people are we training today to actually really understand? If you know, we used to say, I used to say this to the Amazon guys, congratulations, you've joined, fast forward 3 years, you're leading a team. Half your team is people, half your team is the machines. And that was the lived reality 6 or 7 years ago. And our job was to teach you how to manage machines. It's a hard problem. And yet I look at people deploying these systems throughout the place with no ability to audit and inspect their performance. That's very dangerous. Secondly, and this is very topical, I know the minister is all over this, but who gets the value? I think this is particularly pertinent to us in the UK. As you heard from Wendy, you know, supercomputer, arms race, whatever. Fundamentally, compute, even the algorithms, talent, these will probably be pretty commoditized. The scarce resource is truly properly structured annotated data sets. The UK, you know, partly through some very far-sighted investment decisions, has some of the world's most important data sets, and we give them away for free. And if you look at, and you know, that's okay, nothing wrong with it, open government, research use 100%, public benefit 100%, but does it really make sense that the UK taxpayer funded the creation of a lot of these data sets? If you look at the data from 2023, top 15 countries' private investment in AI, UK was 4%. It's punching above our weight, but put it another way, 24 out of 25 business users getting the value from UK data and not in the UK. And I think that's something we need to think about. A couple of very quick ones, an obvious one. Trust is a massive issue. In these spaces, how and where do you put human in the loop? And even if the machine is better, and I contend in many domains it'll get deployed even if it's not better, because it's the velocity which is what will drive the deployment, there are many situations where you need to have human in the loop, and we haven't really thought through which is it mandatory, isn't it? And then finally, let me just throw out one thing that keeps me awake at night. I mean, for my sins, I ran Amazon's operation in China for 3 years, and I have an amazing, I loved your focus on China, Wendy. I have a long list of things I used to call only in China. But one of the things we discovered very painfully and very expensively is that all of this cool technology and amazing capability is just as available to bad actors as good. And we get a little bit focused on state actors, but trust me, serious organized crime pays very good money and has very good machine learning teams. And they deploy it in very scary and interesting ways that I think we're just quite blindsided to. You see a little bit in the, you know, what happens when obvious things like spear phishing attacks suddenly get really, really good. But there's so many different domains where, and I can't tell you all the confidential details, but when we really drilled back to why are we seeing this level of fraud, why are we seeing the legal, when we did the really deep stuff and you started to trace it, you found at the end of it, serious organized crime, operating extrajudicially in locations that are very hard to pursue and where it's very hard to see it. And I think the bad actor use of smart technology, I think, is underestimated as a risk. So what does all that mean? One final thought. I think the regulation of this space is really important and really quite challenging. And I deeply feel for the amazing work. Well, first of all, I hugely applaud the amazing work Wendy and everybody is doing on this. I think it's fantastic. I love the human-centered. I think it's challenging because it's got to be thoughtful, as Wendy said, as I'm sure the minister will respond to. You've got to think about a global, and by the way, global has to include China. It has to include some of the cool stuff that's going on. But if there is a governing thought here, you know, if I could put one thought out here, if you think about how do we regulate many, many, many new technologies coming in, typically they've generated enormous societal and economic value when the dust settles, but they have brought with them legitimate societal concerns, and that has been true since the invention of the automobile or everything else. You know, there are legitimate societal concerns, I've touched on some of them. And I think the challenge from a regulatory point of view is, and by the way, there's a massive opportunity for regulatory arbitrage here, because the country or the area that gets it right is far more likely to attract the investment and generate the growth. I think the challenge is, which I thought was well laid out, by the way, in that paper you said that's likely to get the audience, is how do you meet the legitimate societal concerns and be really granular about what those are whilst giving the absolute maximum scope for innovation? It's a hard balance to strike, but if we can strike that balance, and I think if we can strike it in the UK, I think it's a brilliant opportunity. Thank you very much indeed. Sorry if I overlapped.